Well, that got your attention, didn't it? Thanks, Dorianne, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks very much for joining us. Today I'll touch on a couple of aspects, including how we believe a portfolio of how infrastructure should have a place in everyone's portfolio, their investment portfolio, and why it's worthy of that consideration for all of your clients. And we'd like to run through the return expectations that you should be able to achieve from infrastructure, and then finally, how you can access it. There's the lawyer's disclaimer. We'll take that as read. Here's the agenda in short. So we'll be running through those points, as I mentioned before. Just how big is the global opportunity set? Dorianne mentioned $100 billion US raised in the last 18 months. What does that mean in the context of the size? We'll set some scene. We'll talk about listed and unlisted, mature versus emerging markets, and how we believe you're best placed to invest in this asset class today. First point you should take heed of is that not all infrastructure is created equal. The critical element when you look at assessing infrastructure investments is that they fulfil the need of the investment objective that the clients want to achieve. Now, we think if you ask the average investor what are the elements that they want from investing in this asset class, they are a long life asset with a low risk of capital loss and inflation linked returns. The other Warren, as I'll refer to him too, a gentleman by the name of Warren Buffett, fame of Berkshire Hathaway, about 7 or 8 years ago was asked a question at the AGM in Omaha, Nebraska, of what he describes as the ideal investment. And in traditional and eloquent Buffett fashion, he replied, an inflation-linked bond with rising coupons. And if you have that construct in your mind as we progress through the presentation, I think that beautifully describes what people want from investing in general, but moreover, what are the attractive elements that you should be seeking to invest in this asset class. And it encapsulates the three characteristics that you see on the slide. But critically, not all infrastructure is created equal, and you must look for those infrastructure assets that can possess these characteristics, because it's those elements that match the long-term liabilities of pension plans and fulfil the criteria that Buffett so eloquently spoke of. Let's look at a couple of case studies. Loyang Power Station, the single largest power station in Australia. 2,000 megawatts based in the Latrobe Valley of Victoria. It is actually Australia's lowest cost power station in terms of direct marginal cost of production, and sits adjacent to a wonderful, very picturesque brown coal mine, which you can see just to the front of the picture. This was an asset originally developed by the SECV, or the Victorian Government, and it is the lowest cost producer in Australia. It was sold by the State Government of Victoria for the then record privatisation price of $4.9 billion back in 1997. The purchasers included two US utilities and Horizon Energy, majority owned by the Infrastructure Trust of Australia, now referred to or now known as Macquarie Infrastructure Group. So this was a Macquarie deal. It's quite a famous Macquarie deal. It's the one they don't like to talk about for obvious reasons. It had debt of $3.6 billion and equity of $1.3, and critically, the purchasers' economics of this deal were predicated on the assumption that this asset had pricing power and that the pool price of electricity would be linked to inflation. It would rise steadily from about $40 a megawatt hour, and the economics of this entire investment case was based on that premise. And it was wrong. What happened? The pool price actually fell to $25 a megawatt hour. Why? This was an oversupplied market. It's a pure commodity product. There is no greater commodity in the world than electricity. No one can tell you exactly what electricity generates the lights that comes out of the light that comes out of the electricity here today. So it ultimately, every single player in that particular industry is selling a commodity at a price where supply meets demand. And unfortunately, supply met demand at $25 a megawatt hour. Now, what happened was this asset got refinanced, sold for $3.5 billion. That was less than the debt that was there. So equity ended up getting the wonderful return of 7 cents, one distribution. So it shows you that not all infrastructure can be a great investment, and you have to be careful what infrastructure investments you're looking for. Now, schematically, why is this the case? Why is it that these unregulated utilities, the producers of this commodity product, don't produce those robust, regular returns that people would expect from infrastructure? Surely all infrastructure is the same. Well, ultimately, what you see here is that market forces determine revenues and costs are largely fixed, so you have a highly volatile profit stream. Volumes and prices move all over the place depending on where market forces are, and hence you have these highly volatile profit streams in the schematic here. And that leads to an uncertain value. At certain times in the investment cycle, it will create lots of money. At other times, like in the late 1990s, it created very little. Let's contrast that with a fully regulated utility. Now, in Australia, what we're talking about here are the natural monopolies, things like power, electricity distribution networks, so the guy that owns the power to your home, or the transmission networks, those large poles and wires. They are a very different type of asset. They are a natural monopoly, and as a consequence of that, they are fully regulated. What happens in this environment is that the asset base of what that asset is deemed to be worth earns a very stable rate of return determined by a regulator. That return has costs added to it, and hey presto, that's the revenue that that company earns. Now, there's a loop back there to the rate of return, so ultimately what the regulator seeks to do is to give a very defined, stable pattern of returns to that asset, and that results in a very defined, stable pattern of returns to investors. Let's talk about another type of investment that we believe is what investors want from investing in infrastructure. Concessioned assets such as toll roads. These are assets that typically have long-term government mandates. They very often are typified by having a protected income stream. Often a monopoly position again, and hence that concept of regulation. In the case of a toll road, what happens here is the return is not regulated, but the toll that is charged is. So for the next 50 years, for argument's sake, as you will travel back to the city, you will hopefully travel on the Eastern Distributor. That road, the toll is almost set in, enshrined in legislation, or sorry, in its concession agreement for the next 50 years. It will earn either a rate of 4% per annum or the greater of 2/3 average weekly earnings or inflation. So every quarter, little calculation comes out. Average weekly earnings went up by 4 and a bit, inflation went up by 3, 2/3, 1/3, 3.5, 4% is greater, 4%. And then every time that that toll ratchets up by 50 cents, bang, you're paying more. And that's known, set in stone for the next 50 years. They're the types of assets that we think investors want from investing in infrastructure. How big is the opportunity set? There's two worlds in infrastructure, and we'll come to this in a few slides' time. But to give you a feel for how big the size is, the total market capitalization today of infrastructure within the developed world. So these are infrastructure situated in OECD countries, and this is infrastructure that's owned by companies listed on exchanges of those OECD countries, is today roughly $2 trillion. US $2 trillion. Compare and contrast that with direct. Now, the data on direct is very difficult to come by, but get understandings that we have with a number of the investment banks to try and isolate how big that market is, we estimate it's somewhere between $300 and $500 billion. So although there is a plethora of product available in the direct space, that is how traditionally investment funds in Australia have accessed infrastructure, it is by far the smaller of the two investment avenues for which you can get access to this asset class. That's a very important point when we come to how you should be able to cherry pick these assets for those investment characteristics that you want from investing in infrastructure. The other key point to take away from this slide is there's a few. One is if you want adequate asset diversification, if you want to be able to spread the risk of what we'll call exogenous shock, be it earthquake, be it terrorism, the only way you can do that is to look globally across a whole sphere of different assets, because no one geography in the globe offers adequate asset diversification. The second point to take away is there is a whole lot of rubbish in the press about how far behind the rest of the world the United States is in infrastructure. Okay, it's true for one thing. This. So the traditional assets that people like UniSuper have owned, the toll roads, etc., yes, the United States hasn't had a lot of privatisation of those assets. but in the utility space, they have been at the forefront of privatisation for not 20 or 30 years, which is what the which is what Australia and the United Kingdom has, but for over 200 years. Consolidated Edison of New York is the only way you get power on the island of Manhattan. It has been doing the same job for 200 years and has been listed on the NYSE for 180 years. It's one of the longest listed companies in the United States. And it's a provider of electricity. It's a fully regulated monopoly. And it sits in the United States. So just be careful of how people will rewrite history, if you will, just to try and satisfy their needs. So we spoke at the beginning about not all infrastructure being equal. We call the infrastructure that we think you want to invest in preferred infrastructure. It is unashamedly a smaller subset of the broader infrastructure market, and it's typified by assets that have high degrees of revenue certainty, the capacity to translate that into very predictable, defined investment returns to equity investors through either distributions, dividends, or capital returns, and the capacity to do this for long periods of time. The types of factors that we look for are stable demand profiles. These assets are often monopolies in the markets in which they operate. As a consequence of that monopoly status, they are regulated. Okay? Unfortunately, there are only a handful of unregulated monopolies in the world. Right? You know, as much as I want to have an unregulated monopoly because I'm a greedy little capitalist, they don't really exist very often in the world. There is one asset, the 407 in Ontario, Canada, which is without question the single greatest asset in the globe. Ignore infrastructure. If God came to you and said you can only put your money in one place, you would put it in the 407. For 99 years, you can charge whatever you want to the 400,000 odd people that use that road every single day, and there's nothing that the government can do about it, as long as you don't double the tolls in 6 months. So it's an unregulated utility. Unfortunately, most of them are regulated, but that's a good thing because the regulator assures that you get the adequate return that you're required. High operating margins are typically what we look for, and guess what happens when you have stable revenues and high margins? Banks love to lend these companies money. So sustainable gearing is critically important when you look at infrastructure. A lot of the companies that we look at, and particularly given the credit markets that we're seeing today, we look for fixed rates of debt for long periods of time. One of the key points is the Macquarie Bank has very cleverly played interest rate markets over the past decade and a half since I followed this sector. When they first entered the infrastructure market, they took a call that interest rates were high. They had short-term debt, fully floating rate. As interest rates have come down and they were able to secure much more favourable terms, guess what they did with a lot of their assets? Longer-term debt, fixed. So they've played the interest rate cycle. And today, Macquarie Infrastructure Group, a company which is considered interest rate sensitive, has about 92% of its debt fully fixed for the next 2 years and 85% of its debt fixed for 7. So there isn't a lot of interest rate sensitivity in that company, and that's the sort of company that we look for. Sustainable gearing structures. Okay? Direct guys love to gear these things up because they're rewarded on equity IRR, and they get paid a bonus when they get their equity IRR higher. So what do? Lever the things up excessively. Okay, debt coverage ratios in the direct space are typically 2 times or less, debt to assets of about 90%. Now, the investment bankers will call this an efficient capital structure. I call it a hell of a lot of risk that equity really doesn't need to bear. Because in the listed space, same assets, in the preferred infrastructure listed space, so we're talking about those assets with monopoly characteristics, stable demand, you're looking at 5 times EBITDA interest cover, debt to funds employed of about 50%. That's actually not that dissimilar to the average company listed on the MSCI, to the average company listed on the global exchanges of the world, regardless of the very low risk characteristics they have. Finally, and a point I'll come to later, we believe investors investing in this sort of infrastructure investment, wanting returns that we believe sit between bonds and equities, should only invest in the mature markets of the world. Emerging markets offer a very different risk-return profile, and we'll talk specifically as to why we believe that is not a prudent place to invest your money, and particularly today. Just to re-emphasise the point, infrastructure ownership, as we'll call it, sits in that space between fixed interest or bonds and equities. Okay, they've got more operating risk than a bond, but they've got clearly less operating risk than the average industrial company. And so they fill that space in between bonds and equities. Okay, for those of us that want to talk about equity beta, the equity beta of listed infrastructure companies around the globe for the last 15 years has been around about 0.6, 0.5, 0.6. Preferred infrastructure sits at the lower end of that given its lower risk characteristics. And infrastructure development, if you will, is what I refer to as greenfield development, or particularly in emerging markets. You should be afforded a higher return because you're taking a hell of a lot more risk on. If what you want is that inflation-linked bond with rising coupons, if you want to follow Warren Buffett, you want to sit in between bonds and fixed interest. So let's compare listed versus direct. Let's compare the pair, if you will. The advantages of direct infrastructure are clearly that you will earn a higher return in the long run. You should, for the very simple reason that you should be rewarded for illiquidity. The direct space, you cannot buy and sell an asset every single day, as you can in the listed space. So because of that illiquidity, you should be afforded a higher return. Secondly, you can have a smoothed return profile. You can go to what I used to do, little chartered accountants, give them your financial model, they play with the model, and guess what? The value just easily creeps up every single year until they have to sell it, and then, of course, they really find out what it's worth. But ultimately, you get that smooth return profile. Listed provides you with the added advantage of immediate access. Far greater diversification. Again, listed is 6 times the size of direct, and the added bonus of daily liquidity. So in terms of daily pricing, you get a market in which a seller meets a buyer on a daily basis and determines the price at which it's exchanged. The disadvantages, So disadvantages for direct and unlisted, illiquidity on disposal, lumpy investments. You might be sitting on money for 18 months, 2 years, given the $100 billion raised, a lot longer, if you're prudent with your investment capital, or you can pay up for it, as some people have. And you have high specific investment risk. The single largest direct investor in infrastructure in the globe is Ontario Teachers, which is a pension plan in Canada. It is a $100 billion US plan. They have an allocation to infrastructure of 10%. They have 30-odd people around the globe effectively competing against investment banks for these infrastructure assets. They've been investing in this space for nearly 15 years. They today have 14 investments. They've made 16, two of them they lost money on, one of which, of course, the famous Cross City Tunnel, the road to nowhere. Not many people travel from Paddington to the fish markets, but someone wanted to build it, so there it is. So they today don't have what I would call a diversified portfolio, and they've been doing it for 15 years. So you take a lot higher specific risk. Now, that comes with the idea of higher returns. It's just like private equity. Okay, you take higher risk, you should be afforded higher returns. Listed markets, short-term correlation to listed equities. No question about it. Okay? Our fund that we've been running now for 18 months, and it's not an advertorial, but it's a way of explaining the situation. We have seen markets, of course, fall since June by about 7 or 8% across the globe. Our fund is down by about 4 or 5. Now, that sort of short-term volatility is what you're going to be seeing because you're priced every single day. You can't hide behind the accountant's little computer. And you should expect lower returns in the long run. Okay? You get the added bonus of liquidity means you should expect to have lower returns in the listed space. So what does that mean where the ideal investment arena is? In our minds, what we think is there is clearly two markets that have opened up if you look at this investment market, if you look at this space objectively. Clearly, if you're investing in greenfield projects, new startup developments, toll roads, new startup projects, etc., you should be looking at direct and unlisted because you take out the equity market noise, which is so important to you when you're employing capital at the early stages. And secondly, developing markets. A lot of their investment will be greenfield. Listed, high free cash flow generation. And essentially comparing and contrasting listed and direct is like comparing and contrasting mature with developing markets. And what I mean by that is the listed market has the lower cost of capital, ultimately, because that's where clearly the lower cost of capital exists. You should be getting a lower return from it. But it also is at the investment life cycle stage in the infrastructure development where you're milking the free cash flow. Okay? 40, 50 years ago, governments built the backbones of society that we are today being able to relish the investment opportunities from. emerging markets are still building their backbones of society, which is what infrastructure is. Okay, so it's a different place in the investment stage life cycle, and therefore I think is better suited to direct or unlisted. Deal flow, Dorian spoke about it at the start, $100 billion in the last 18 months. Many more listed opportunities than unlisted, I think six times the size. Since 2000, January 2000, there were $100 billion worth of deals consummated in the infrastructure space. 80% of them were listed companies buying other listed companies. So there's $20 billion worth of deals available for unlisted or direct. Now let's compare and contrast that with $20 billion over six years. We raised $29 billion in the first 6 months of 2006, and we've raised a bit more than $50 billion in the 12 months since then. So just under $100 billion to loose guesstimate. But we only invested $20 billion in the 6.5 years before that. 120. That's wall of capital, dearth of investment opportunities, does create people having to be very prudent in their investment decisions. Contrasted to the listed space, more than $100 billion of IPOs have occurred since 2000, and today we're aware of more than 12 coming to market over the next 6 to 12 months, about $30 billion worth. So direct eyes will stand up and talk about deal flow. Yes, there is deal flow out there, but most of it goes to the listed space. I think it's a appreciation of the qualities that this asset class has to bring and a clear trend towards alternative investments. So you've seen people moving away from traditional bonds and equities, but I'm happy to take questions at the end if I can just press through, if that's all right. So let's talk about the unlisted funds and how they've done. Let's look at a couple of deals. BAA, which is the owner of Heathrow Airports and the London Airport Exchange and Associated British Ports, two transactions. We owned both these stocks in our portfolios. We sold them before the deals were finalised because we stick to value and we think they paid about 30% more than they're actually worth. We think Ferrovial will struggle to make money out of that, and we also believe Goldman Sachs will severely struggle to make an adequate investment rate of return on ABP. Unless, of course, they gear the hell out of it and then everyone thinks that that's okay. The other way to look at it is, let's compare and contrast a couple of airport transactions, and there were a few of them done. The average EV to EBITDA multiple, and I hate using multiples as a measure of value, but let's just use it as an illustration, was the average price, say, 25 times EV to EBITDA. We own two airports in our portfolio today. Their EV to EBITDA is 11. But hang on, you told me that unlisted or direct should get a higher return, therefore they should pay less for those assets because they're lumpy and illiquid. Why are they paying 2.5 times what listed markets are trading at? Because they don't have $100 billion chasing $20 billion worth of deals. So let's talk about two little investments that we think are ones for your PA fund, or if you like, you can invest in our products. Sorry, Dorian. First, Red Electrica. What is Red Electrica? That's a picture of one of its assets. It's the big poles and wires, the transmission grid of Spain. It is a monopoly asset. It owns all of the transmission grid of Spain and controls the timing of when electricity generators sell their power into the grid. It is a fully regulated utility. It gets a full 7% post-tax return on its asset base. Now, that doesn't matter actually how much volume of electricity goes down that asset base. So it's unbelievably robust under all economic scenarios. They spend a dollar, they get 7% return on it. Spend a dollar, 7% return. 65% operating margins, fixed costs, wonderful business. Why is it cheap today? Essentially, Spain is being used as the European Union's way of dealing with greenhouse gas emissions. Simple, real simple story. Effectively, what they're doing is they're putting in place 30% of their electricity has to be wind-powered by the year 2020. To do that, they need to incur enormous amounts of transmission capital to get transmission grids, the big poles and wires, out to where the wind blows. But the other flip side of wind power is that it only blows about 30% of the time if you put a tower, a wind, you know, the wind generators in a good spot. So what that means is you need to have gas sitting alongside it so that for the 70% of time that the wind isn't blowing, you can still generate power. So effectively, Spain is building 30% more than it of electricity than it needs to, because it wants to have wind, but it needs gas to support it. This business, as I said, every single dollar that gets spent on the transmission grid, they get a guaranteed return on. And the simple math is, this asset is trading on a 14% free cash flow yield. It's getting a 7% regulated return, which is meant to be what the free cash flow yield is. 14%, 7%, that means it's half price. That's about right. Second asset, it's a toll road in Italy. We like toll roads in Italy, not because we particularly want to drive Ferraris to Venice, but because we think they're wonderful little assets. This is a preferred infrastructure asset. CIAS, and I don't ask me to try and pronounce the full Spanish name for it, owns an asset in Italy, in the northeast of Italy, called Cisa, the Cisa toll road. It's the green one, this one. Goes from La Spezia in the south to just outside Parma in the north. 70% of the people that use this road, and it's been opened and operating for about 20-odd years, travel up to Verona. So, unfortunately, what happened in Spain was, in 2010, this concession was due to expire. Because remember what happens with toll roads? You own them for a period of time, then it goes. In Australia, they go, and there's no payment to the owner of the toll road. In Italy, there's a terminal value. So in 2010, the Italian government would have had to pay CS 200 million euros. Italian government doesn't have 200 million euros, so what do they do? Aha, I got an idea. Why don't you build an extension to the road? Cisa sits down, it's extension to the road. Yeah, okay, we'll do it. This is the deal we want. We want to be able to toll the whole road until 2044. Okay, done. We want to be able to get at the end of 2044 800 million euros. Okay, done. And then what we want is for the first 10 years that we own the entire section of road, we want to be able to increase the tolls at 6.6% per annum above inflation. Okay, done. This part of the road is going to cost them 1.5 billion euros to build, and we think it's worth 3.5 billion euros. This is on a market cap of a company that today is around about 2 billion euros. So for patient capital, this is a very nice little investment. Emerging markets. I could stand up and talk to you about why I don't think emerging markets are the place to put your money. I could talk about the issues regarding greenfield development, the fact that they won't be highly free cash flow generative for many decades to come because they're building the backbone of society, so they're going to have to reinvest in the road network, etc. The best way to talk about this is to go to the man who was nominated as Ernst & Young's Entrepreneur of the Millennium. He is a long-standing investor in China, based in Hong Kong, strong Chinese ties. I can't tell you what he does, but he owns all the ports and he owns a mobile phone company here in Australia with the name Hutch. So I think it's Hutchison Wapoa might be his name. Yeah, I didn't say that. Multi-billion dollar conglomerate. Okay, they have been investing in China for more than a decade. They have $50 billion invested in China. Now, they very proudly tell us that they have regarded their investment in China as being highly fruitful, and they have exited 4 investments and got their money back. No, that's not after adjusting for time value of money. That's not after adjusting and for an adequate level of return. They put a dollar in a decade ago, and 10 years later, they got a dollar back. Now, they consider that very good simply because of just how poor the investment structures are in China for them to be able to invest. And this is a person based in Hong Kong, strong Chinese ties, entrepreneur of the millennium. So their strategy with their own infrastructure dollar is to be OECD focused, not to invest in China or any other emerging market. So the question then has to be, well, why would you want to invest in emerging markets? What are the risks? The key one is enforceability of contract. The key risk you bear investing in infrastructure, bar everything else, is political and regulatory risk. You must have political and regulatory certainty before you invest a dollar of your money. And what does the foreigner bring to the table? Do you bring capital? Chinese don't need capital. They've got massive saving rates. In fact, they're funding the rest of the world because we all spend more than we earn. Do we bring management expertise? Well, the reason you like infrastructure is because management can't bugger it up, basically. It's just it's a drover's dog asset, as a person once explained to me. Anyone can run them. So what do emerging market promoters need foreign investment for? They don't. So why do you want to put your money there? What are the risks investing in infrastructure? I've touched on the key one, regulatory and political risk. These are monopoly assets, they're subject to regulation. You have to be conscious of the risk that you bear. Gearing, I've mentioned before the difference between direct and listed. And I ask you to be very conscious of the return that you get as an equity investor. I can very simply increase my equity IRR without adding a single dollar of value to the asset. I take a gearing structure today and I re-gear it tomorrow. Equity IRR went up. Hey, did I create value? No. The asset didn't change. We own two units down here at Coogee. One's fully geared, the other's completely ungeared. One has a completely different equity IRR to the next, but they're still two units. They're still worth the same money if they're identical asset. Don't lose sight of what you're buying here. You're buying assets, the equity that those assets have. And the real interest rate risk is without doubt the key one that you bear from an economic point of view. Real interest rates are artificially low around the world because idiot actuaries force defined benefit pension plans into them at any cost, because it's a way of immunising their liability. The way you need to manage that is to watch what real interest rates do. When we value a company, we use what we believe is the long-term intrinsic interest rate of that particular country, not what the prevailing short-term rate is. And finally, if you're investing in equity markets, be conscious of noise. So how should you invest in infrastructure today? Final slide before I take any questions. We think you should look at ownership because that's the assets that provide the match to pension plans. We think if you want that return profile that Buffett spoke of, the inflation-linked bond with rising coupons, you have to invest in what we call preferred infrastructure. Not all infrastructure is created equal. You need to look global. It's a much greater opportunity set, and there's opportunities there to diversify your portfolio. You should invest in OECD, not emerging market countries, simply because of the political risk and an insufficient risk-return equation, in our opinion. We would argue that you should go listed, not direct. Direct have the issues of the wall of capital, dearth of opportunities. Listed has immediate access, diversification and liquidity. The risk can be managed. If you're prudent about the way you allocate capital, you can manage risk in this asset class. And finally, we think global listed infrastructure is not only a viable alternative, but we believe it's the optimal way to gain exposure to this very exciting asset class. Thank you for your time.